This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So for Israel, that's the first priority, and I think that's the reason that they're holding off on a ground invasion.
That's reporter Linda Gradstein about the possibility of an Israeli ground attack in Gaza. Details coming up also. Nigeria's Supreme Court today upheld President Bola Tinubu's election victory in February and detained Senegalese opposition figure Ousmane Sonko is reportedly very weak after resuming a hunger strike. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. More than a week after Hamas infiltrated Israel with a surprise attack, it seems the region stands on the brink of war with fears of a wilder conflict. I first asked our reporter in Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein, who is closely monitoring the conflict, if the situation is escalating.
It is escalating. I mean, you know, Hamas continues to fire rockets at Israel, including longer-range rockets that are hitting the Tel Aviv area. There was one rocket that hit a suburb of Tel Aviv and did severe damage to one of the buildings. And at the same time, Israeli bombing raids on Gaza are stepping up as well. There are more people being killed on both sides. And for the first time, actually, Israeli tanks and troops went briefly into northern Gaza in what it called a targeted raid. But nobody seems to be backing down on this at all.
The military saying the raid was carried out yesterday in preparation for the next stages of combat?
Yes, you know, Israel's been talking about a ground assault now for, you know, it'll be on Saturday, it'll be 3 weeks since this started when Hamas and thousands of Hamas fighters crossed the border from Gaza into Israel and just attacked all of these different communities. For over 2 weeks now, more than 300,000 Israeli reservists are massed at the border. There are tanks. I think Israel sort of hasn't decided if it's going to do a widespread incursion of Gaza. And if that happens, then, you know, you're talking about months of fighting, or they're going to do sort of pinpointed things. But Israel has basically said over and over, Israeli officials, military officials, that Israel cannot coexist anymore with Hamas after what they did. Now, Hamas has thousands of fighters in Gaza in a series of underground tunnels. So any kind of ground invasion, urban warfare is going to be a very long process. But as sort of signal that nobody expects this to be short, the former chief of staff, Benny Gantz, basically said that Israelis who have been evacuated either from the southern areas near Gaza or the northern borders near Lebanon should prepare to be away from their homes for at least 3 months.
And world leaders, including UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, Turkey's President Tayyip Erdogan, even Vladimir Putin. One is saying this could escalate. The other is saying we need humanitarian aid in the area. I mean, is this making any dent in the mindset of Israel?
I don't think so. I mean, look, Israel's main issue is the hostages, first of all. And the Qatar has been trying to negotiate a release for at least the women and children. We just got a report that two of the children being held hostage are Hungarian citizens, according to Budapest. That's something new. But we know that there are quite a few Thai agricultural workers who were kidnapped, as well as dual Israeli Americans, Brits, Canadians. So for Israel, that's the first priority. And I think that's the reason that they're holding off on a ground invasion. At the same time, there have been press reports that the United States has asked Israel to hold off partly because to get some more humanitarian aid into Gaza, which is really on the brink of a collapse, and also to get more American air defenses into the region in case American troops are targeted. But the sense is that Israel will do some kind of ground invasion in the next few days, although it's been like that now for almost 2 weeks.
And the UN is asking for delivery to enter into Gaza. Is the main delivery fuel?
Yes. So Israel has said it will not allow fuel into Gaza because it says that Hamas has fuel, and it's published a photo of all these tanks that they say are full of fuel that Hamas has been using for rockets and to run these tunnels and things like that that they have. Israel is allowing in food and medicine. However, it's not enough. There are an estimated 750,000 Palestinians in the southern city of Rafah, which many of them have left the north after Israel warned residents to leave and said they should flee south and they'll be safer in the south. There have been, however, Israeli bombing raids targeting the entire Gaza Strip, not just the north, but also the south. And the bureau chief of Al Jazeera in Gaza, Wael Dubuh, his family was killed in an Israeli strike on the Nusayrat refugee camp. He sent them there, which is in central Gaza. He sent them there to keep them safe.
And lastly, the death toll on both sides, where does it stand right now?
So the death toll in Israel is 1,400, mostly civilians. Mostly from that first day of the Hamas assault almost 3 weeks ago. The death toll on the Palestinian side is over 7,000. Those figures, though, are from the Palestinian Health Ministry, which Israel says is run by Hamas. The ministry says it is independent. It is not run by Hamas. And there's really no way to independently check those figures, but it's certainly thousands of Palestinians who were killed.
Linda Gradstein, who's closely monitoring the conflict, she talked to me from Jerusalem. The Abraham Accords in 2020 normalized Israel's political, economic, and diplomatic relations with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco. Now attention is focused on the Gaza Strip and whether the conflict widens and grows into another militant groups or neighboring and regional states. Sources have told Reuters that Saudi Arabia is putting normalization plans on ice, a blow for U.S. President Joe Biden and Israel. Edmund Garib, a professor of Middle East history at the American University in Washington, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi the prospects of Israeli-Saudi normalization, which seemed so close to being sealed.
There's no doubt that the Biden administration has put this issue at the top of its priorities in the Middle East. It had made a lot of efforts to try to promote the Abrahamic Accords and specifically to bring about peace between or settlement between the Saudi government and the Israeli government. Although there is a question how close they were, but I think there were a lot of efforts, and we've heard that the Saudis were willing to reach an agreement, but as long as Palestinian rights are respected and recognized, and clearly the Saudi crown prince has made it very obvious that there cannot be peace in the Middle East and a settlement of the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli conflict unless there is a Palestinian state and a viable Palestinian state. This is also had been is the position adopted by the Arab League, actually, under a Saudi initiative when King Abdullah was the king of Saudi Arabia. So this is not something that is really new. Nevertheless, I think the point that you're making is a very important one in the sense that what we are seeing now is that this tension, this war that's taking place in Gaza, the unrest in the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem, and especially if it spreads to the holy places in Jerusalem, is going to make it very, very difficult for other parties in the region, even those that have made already peace with Israel, to continue to adopt their previous positions. We are likely to see that this is going to severely damage, if not destroy, the Pax Americana in the Middle East that previous administration, the Biden administration, as well as the Trump administration sought to achieve by bringing fulfillment of the Abrahamic Accords to bring peace between the two sides.
But how would the war in Gaza and its human ramification impact the countries that already normalized relations with Israel, especially Morocco, with Moroccan Jews in the population?
Clearly, this is already affecting many of the countries. Even if the government, sometimes some governments do not want to basically change their stands, or they think that there are other ways to bring about settlements and peaceful. Nevertheless, we are seeing public opinion in many of these countries becoming very, very critical of the policies of their own governments and showing a great deal of sympathy and support for the plight of the Palestinian people in light of what's going on in Gaza, where you are seeing daily attacks. You have seen thousands of people dying. Save Our Children organization has warned of the deaths of thousands and thousands of children. And there's a million children, as the organization says, in Gaza, and many thousands of these are likely to die if the current situation continues. So this is extremely dangerous. It's also very dangerous for U.S. policy in the region at a time when you are seeing rising confrontations and tensions between the NATO and Russia in Ukraine, maybe some other areas as well, between China and the United and its allies and the United States and its allies. And on top of that, we are seeing the events unfolding in Africa as well as in now in Gaza and in Israel. And this is likely to be or bring about a strategic blow to U.S. interests and U.S. policies.
That was Edmund Gharib, professor of Middle East history at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. With the death toll rising in the conflict between Israel and Hamas, Egypt is working to foster peace and is urging the parties to come to the negotiating table. Angie Omar reports from Cairo.
Egyptian officials say the country's experience in conflict resolution and its 45-year-old peace treaty with Israel, the Camp David Accords, provide a foundation for mediation efforts in the conflict between Israel and Hamas. The government last week organized a peace summit in Cairo, bringing regional and European officials together to discuss ways to encourage direct talks between Hamas and Israel. At the summit, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said Egypt wants to see civilians protected.
مصر تدين بوضوح كامل استهداف أو قتل أو ترويع
President Sisi says Egypt strongly condemns targeting or killing or intimidating all peaceful civilians. He goes on to say, Egypt expresses great astonishment that the world is standing by and watching a catastrophic humanitarian crisis affecting 2.5 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The conflict began on October 7, when Hamas fighters from the Gaza Strip assaulted several Israeli communities, killing more than 1,000 people and kidnapping more than 200. Since then, Israel has bombarded Gaza and blocked shipments of food, fuel, water, and medicines, killing thousands. To facilitate negotiations, Egypt has offered diplomatic channels and resources. The country has a history of brokering ceasefires between Hamas and Israel, and Egyptian leaders say they can help bridge the divide between the two. Rasha Qandil is a British journalist, a professor at the American University in Cairo, and a non-resident fellow at Washington's Center for International Policy.
Egypt is the only party that can play the role of mediating between the Palestinian authorities, Hamas militants, and also Israel on the other side. And as you said, because it's a delicate situation, so priorities need to be made. So I think a ceasefire is the Egyptian priority for the time being. The complex situation on the Rafah checkpoint and the cross borders would also follow that probably in the coming week or so.
Egypt also has been engaging with regional and international stakeholders, including the United Nations, the United States, and other Arab nations, to rally support for the peace process and to ensure any agreements reached are implemented. Saeed Sadiq is an Egyptian professor of peace studies at the Egypt-Japan University of Science and Technology.
Most likely after the end of this conflict, Egypt and the international community, the regional power, would call for an international conference to apply the two-state solution that was envisioned in 1947. Since 1947, there was this understanding that the two peoples cannot be together in one state. And so they had this partition of Palestine in 1947, but it was rejected by the Arabs and some of the Israelis. But, you know, successive UN resolution also called for a two-state solution. The Oslo Agreement in 1993 called for a two-state solution.
There are challenges to Egypt's effort to mediate in the crisis. The deep-rooted historical and political grievances between Hamas and Israel, along with the divergent interests of various regional governments, present significant hurdles. Rasha Kandil explains there are challenges to facilitating a meaningful dialogue between the parties. The first is sustaining a ceasefire that would allow discussions to continue. There is also an issue of trust.
The lack of trust happening in many of the Arab countries and probably at some of the Arab regimes as well towards the United States as being a neutral mediator. President Joe Biden's visit to the Middle East was very clear about an unconditional support to Israel. So the only party that can actually play the difficult role is Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and maybe some of the other normalizing countries with Israel. How can we put this on one table? God only knows.
Egypt also is working to ease the humanitarian crisis in Gaza by supplying aid itself and working with the United Nations, Israeli and Gazan authorities to get aid in via Egypt's Rafah crossing. However, Egypt has not opened the crossing fully, and only several dozen aid trucks have gone in, far short of the hundreds needed daily. It also is not letting refugees from Gaza to Egypt. For VOA Africa, this is Inji Omar in Cairo.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Detained Senegalese opposition figure Ousmane Sonko, who 8 days ago resumed a hunger strike, is very weak. And in an intensive care unit, one of his lawyers told Agence France-Presse Wednesday, Sonko, who intends to contest the presidential election in February, has accused President Macky Sall of using legal procedures to torpedo his political career, an accusation the president denies. On June 1st, Sonko was sentenced in absentia to 2 years in prison for morally corrupting a young person, sparking fatal clashes. His name was removed from electoral list following the conviction. A judge last week ruled against his removal from the lists, but it is still not guaranteed that he will be able to run for president next year. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee this week held a hearing on the implications of instability in the Sahel and West Africa on U.S. foreign policy. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reports.
Since 2020, there have been coups in Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Chad, and Niger. Mali and Burkina Faso have actually had 2 coups. At the same time, there has been an alarming increase in terrorist attacks by militant Islamist organizations. In his opening remarks, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Ben Cardin, said the committee will examine this recent wave of coups and violence.
So today we're going to examine this recent wave of coups and violence and what it means for U.S. policy. The challenges are great, but we must acknowledge the current trajectory is grim. It requires a critical evaluation of our policies. Congress demanded that when we passed the Trans-Sahel Counterterrorism Partnership Act.
Senator Cardin explained that although junta leaders have justified their coups by pointing to their elected government's failure to improve security, they themselves have failed to deliver as well. In both Mali and Burkina Faso, security has sharply deteriorated and civilian deaths have skyrocketed. The spiraling security situation, he said, is already impacting coastal West African nations, and the committee is trying to find out what is driving this dynamic.
It's hard to say our security assistance has been effective in the Sahel or in countries in West Africa. We certainly have very little to show in terms of the improved security, stability, or stronger democratic institutions. And quite frankly, there is an uncomfortable truth in all this. Across the Sahel, the United States trained militias and militaries were responsible for the coups. We have trained the very people overthrowing civilian governments. So it's critical that we take a brutally honest look at our approach to date.
The senator noted that the presence of the Russian Wagner mercenary group presents an additional serious threat and noted that ultimately the course of history in other countries is up to the people who live there. However, he added that we have the responsibility to at least do no harm through our approach and stand in solidarity along with millions of Africans with democratic aspirations living in dictatorial regimes. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee is in charge of leading foreign policy legislation and debate in the Senate. It's generally responsible for overseeing and funding foreign aid programs and funding arms sales and training for national allies. Douglas Impuga, VOA News, Washington.
Media watchdogs and journalists in Zimbabwe are fuming after members of the Vice Presidential Security Detail ordered journalists to delete photos and videos of second Vice President Kembo Mohadi collapsing at a campaign rally last Saturday, as Mohadi was airlifted to an unknown destination for medical attention. The security detail rounded up journalists, ordering them to wipe out recordings of the event. Columbus Mavunga has more from Harare.
Journalists from both private and government-controlled media who were covering a SANPF rally where Mohadi collapsed are refusing to speak openly after being forced to delete recordings of the dramatic event in Gudu District, about 3-hour drive south of Harare. One of them, we shall call Vumba, narrates what happened after Vice President Mohadi collapsed at the podium.
Soon after his collapse, security agents and some ZANPF officials rushed to where journalists were standing, including from the state media and private. And we were asked to delete our footage, and some of the journalists' phones were taken so for further checks, especially from those from the private media. The phone was taken for 10 to 15 minutes. Soon after then, there was the security was always on journalists, checking what are they doing, and also cross-checking the stories that they are going to write. Some of the officials from ZANPF said that, I know there's no story here about the collapse of VP.
Commenting on the episode, Vumba says,
for us as journalists, I think it's not good, since we have the right to our phones, for our privacy, and also we have the right to inform the nation.
Tabani Moyo, head of Media Institute of Southern Africa, agrees.
A story of that nature is of national interest. To then round up journalists and request them to delete footage of a public figure who has collapsed, I think it is unfortunate. We hope that security forces will rethink their approach towards a media liaison and equally put mechanisms that protects both the journalists and their public officials, so that there's no intrusion into one other's lens.
5 days later, there is still no news on the second vice president's condition or even an acknowledgement from government sources that he might be unwell. Conducted for comment, both ZANPF officials and Jenfan Muswere, Zimbabwe's Minister of Information, refused to comment on the incident. Perfect Hlongwane, Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists, calls the incident a sad and unfortunate violation.
It is not just a violation on journalistic rights, but it is also a violation of the Constitution itself that gives those rights to media practitioners and journalists. And we want to call on government officials to say that they must actually be in the forefront to ensure that the Constitution itself is upheld.
Speaking Wednesday, first Vice President Constantino Chiwenga did not comment on Mohadi's collapse, but said Zimbabwe respected all human rights and freedoms. He was speaking to protesters running against sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe's leadership in the early 2000s by United States and the European Union on grounds of election rigging and human rights abuses. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.